This is a Capricorn FM podcast.
So let's look at the issues that we're talking about with Professor Moshe Nkonde. Prof, good evening. Welcome to Progressive Talk.
Good evening. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you very much for being with us, Prof. I appreciate your time as always. Now, Prof, the country is remembering the last apartheid president, F.W. de Klerk. What was your first interaction with him, if you remember, perhaps?
My first interaction when he was still on the staff of this time, Potchefstroom University. And I was then a student leader in the country. And I went to Poch. When I went to Poch, I addressed members of Senate. And because I didn't agree with apartheid, I was given, you know, honorary white status. But when I started, you know, defying apartheid, I had to run out of town. So that's my first comedy. That was many, many years ago.
You were given honorary white status.
Yeah, those days you were given, if you're going to do something in the white area, you were given honorary white status.
So you've been white before, Prof?
Because, you know, those are the days when in the world, it was the days of detente, man.
Yeah.
When Richard Nixon went to meet with Chairman Mao.
Yeah.
Foster went to meet with Kaunda. And because I was a student leader in this country, I was encouraged, even by my own comrades, to go and talk to members of the Afrikaners during the bond and nuisance.
Yeah.
So I was there as a representative of a new global move to come to terms with the different oppositional ideologies.
Right.
But I didn't last more than an hour there. I was chased out because I took a different stance.
Prof, F.W. de Klerk is the last apartheid president, and people talk about what role he played into the transition into democracy. What is your recollection of such a role?
I'll tell you what. Let's start with the fact that from 1985 to 1989, he headed the State Security Council, and that made me associate him with the death of Chris Hani, Matthew Goniwe, Solomon Mahlangu, Steve Biko, Hero, Tami Miele, Samora Machel, D.C. D'Liza, and 50,000 Angolans who died in the Battle of Kilo Devara. It reminds me of Albi Sex, who has been maimed for life. It reminds me of Anton Lubowski, David Webster, Timor. It reminds me of Father Michael Lepsley, maimed for life. It reminds me of Samora and the Sadat and Penduka, and also Thando Mthembu. And then, of course, what makes it worse, he has the cheek, the temerity to say that apartheid was not a crime against humanity. So I have very painful memories about de Klerk, almost unforgivable memories about him.
From that, of course, Prof, because there are people who would say he was instrumental. I'm not sure that's a heavy word for him. He contributed somewhat in when we moved to democracy, in unbanning of political parties and leaders and so on. What do you make of his contribution there?
Let me tell you, in those days we used to, you know, apartheid was dismissed as being against business. It caused a lot of economic damage. So it was not in the interest of the global flow of capital. That's why the American Congress and so many Western democracies, you know, mobilized against apartheid because it was not good for their economy. So it was not because it was an ethical decision. He was compelled by his supporters worldwide to move away from apartheid because apartheid was unproductive. So don't look at that as an ethical decision. It was an economic imperative for him to move, to be in line with the market flow of things. Yes.
Because I saw a column suggesting that he didn't make an idealistic decision, he made a pragmatic one. Because it was
forced to do it.
Yeah, because it was necessitated
by
the situation.
You know those days, we talked those days of global apartheid. Apartheid was sustained by countries throughout the world who supported apartheid, not because of its ethical value. It had an economic advantage. But that's why it was not anything ethical. And when the Western democracy turned against apartheid, it was also an economic decision and not a moral one.
Outside the decisions that he made, what was your view when he was given the Nobel Peace Prize together with the former President Nelson Mandela there?
You see, the Nobel Peace Prize, in my opinion, in the context of apartheid, in the context of global capitalism, it was really a symbolic gesture. It had no material force. It was a symbolic gesture meant to create a mood in the world for business. So it should not be considered an ethical and spiritual decision. It was a political calculation to make sure that South Africa stayed very central to the economic force in the world. It made space for that. Be careful. You say the Nobel Prize, by the way, have their own politics. Don't think it's also objective, scientific, ethical.
Yeah.
It's a political institution, and they make political decisions. I'll tell you why. In the history of the Nobel Prize, there's been no single socialist economist who ever won Nobel Prize. Not even a single Marxist. So you must be careful about the Nobel Prize, you know, is fundamentally a political, you know, gesture.
And
not a profane one.
As we stay on that, Prof, there are those that today are saying in the latter days he tried to reimagine and there was a revisionist idea around his approach around trying to shape how history would look at him and so-called contribution and otherwise, but that he never apologized or never accepted that what happened in the country. He called it separate development and so on. I just read last week that someone was saying he was even thinking about the possibilities of being charged for apartheid crimes. What do you think was happening there?
When you are pushed by global economic forces to come to terms with the liberation movement, that doesn't amount to a sincere confession. It's a strategic retreat without abandoning your principles. If he really had changed hearts, like people like Dr. Koronhof, he would have joined the liberation movement. He would have joined the ANC. Some people did, by the way, who joined the ANC when they realized that the stark ugliness of apartheid. He never did. Okay. So another test to me, if he really had embraced the ANC, if he really had embraced liberation, he would have joined the ANC. He couldn't do that.
And
he couldn't.
He couldn't, yeah.
You know, you must be careful, you know, that we're dealing here with many families who associate him with the death of loved ones.
Yes.
Let's not be preoccupied with him. Let's be preoccupied with how to make amends for all those family losses. Let's come up with strategies that will make the death of loved ones worth it. Not what about the Duck? What are we doing to make sure that the death of Steve Biko, the death of Chris Hani, is being replaced by a profound system of economics? Let's do that. It's only when you find such replacement will there be consolation
and
in the hearts of those who have lost their loved ones.
And Prof, you know that point you make of consolation and so on. I just wonder when the first democratic parliament was constituted and de Klerk sat in the benches there as co-deputy president, and there were in the other benches members of the ANC and others who they would have looked at a person who fought them, who made them suffer and so on. How was the relationship like then in the beginning?
It was a very that's why the what do you call it, the government of opposites, you know, people who came together. It didn't last. And of course with me, I assess that effort in terms of the extent to which it has come up with policies that address the problems of inequality. the policies that came out of the settlement to which he was a signatory haven't been able to reduce substantially poverty and unemployment. So you may not use the negotiation of which he was a major participant as an excuse for pardoning him. That a settlement inside complicated our democracy. And now we are working very, very hard to make sure that we get rid of the legacies of the settlement. When you look very carefully everywhere, we had to settle, we had to negotiate because of the certain things that we can't do now. And in fact, that the settlement has affected adversely the scope and the pace of change in this country.
I seem to be hearing you to say there is no atonement whatsoever.
No, there is no atonement, no real atonement. Go back, go and talk to Chris Hani's kids now. Go and tell, you know, Ikalate, Goniwa's kids have written, you know, a book, My Father Died for This. Just read that book. That boy was 5 months old when his father was killed by Ditlek. He says, when he looks at the landscape now, he says, did my father die for this? Those are the people you should address and not every Ditlek.
Yeah.
Let's look at the existential conditions in which the bereaved are living now. And then we'll deal with the politics and the ethics of the settlement.
Right. Thank you very much, Prof. Appreciate your time as always. Let's stay on the de Klerk matter. Let's talk to somebody who was there. Mr. Mbazi Mashloa was there in the negotiation team of the ANC at CODESA. He is a former general secretary of COSATU, of course, and he joins us on the line. Mr. Mashloa, good evening. Welcome to Progressive Talk.
No, I don't anger. Not because the death of a human being is not important or should be celebrated, but because, like I've said to others, you know, I mean, here you're dealing with someone who, with sort of like very complex, contradictory history, you know, you can take him from, you know, where and how he grew up, a supporter of apartheid. You look at later when he was in the Bruder Bond and later in the cabinet with P.W. Botha and Foster. He was not amongst the enlightened one. In fact, at the time when he was the Minister of Education, you know, when he was the guy that people had to go to ask if they can be able to be accepted, say, quote unquote, in a white university such as Bath, UCT and others, very many people will tell you that he always turned them down. Of course, on the other hand, you've got to accept that, you know, in 1990, following a number of events, first, there would have been sanctions, there would have been armed action, there would have been strikes internally and marches, but there would also have been a settlement around Namibia, Angola, with the Russians, American, and the Cubans. All of those, I think, would have become a confluence that led to him unbanning the ANC and the rest of the liberation movement and so forth. But I think even as he did so, he thought that he'll be able to control the process, but he was not able to. And then lastly, I mean, if you look later, both during the negotiations, there would have been a number of events that have happened that he pretended he didn't know about, but which he should have known or happened under his watch. The Ipatong massacre, the people that were killed in the Transkei, where he went on television to say some terrorists had been killed. It turned out these were children. Of course, there was his support for Buthelezi and the IFP and the number of people that have died. So you're really dealing with someone like that. And of course, in the end, he would say, yes, apartheid was wrong, but not that very bad.
He says it's separate development. You talk about he thought he would control what happened next. What do you think was his real aim for unbanning the political parties and political leaders?
Well, of course, it would be because, one, as I said, there would have been a lot of pressure internally from the struggle by the various liberation movements. But there would also have been businesses that would have been feeling the pinch in terms of sanctions. But I also have got no doubt that the US, the UK would have said to him, look, this is really the only way to go. But I say that he would have thought that he'll control the system, because even in his position, he would always speak about the need to look at issues of group rights. So for him, you were not going to have majority rule. What you would have is that Machangane, Batonga, Basotho, Bazulu, English, whites, and everybody. Everyone would rule themselves, and then you come together, and then you give everybody group rights. And then, you know, you don't even have a majority rule. You will continue to have a government of national unity. I say this because these were the positions that they tabled. But also, that's really what led him, Opakoso, Mangope, Buthelezi, you know, to try and think they can change things. And in the end, in 1996, when the constitution was adopted and it did not have power sharing, government of national unity as a permanent feature, he left the government of national unity.
So you're saying perhaps while he did 1, 2, 3, he did not necessarily envision the democratic constitution that came out of it, the one that we eventually have and the democracy we eventually enjoy today?
No, obviously. I mean, you know, you always think, well, if we go in there, we've got the numbers, we've got the police. There was also this notion that have always been believed. And I think even de Klerk and most white people believe this thing that no. You know, Opakoso has got Amakosa behind him. The Zulu Nation is behind Buthelezi. They've got the numbers. So if, you know, white, the Zulu Nation and some of the Xhosa people came together, there's no way in which any of the liberation movement would be able to win outright majority.
People, obviously, now when he has departed, will talk about his legacy, will talk about his contribution. What is your take? What is your contribution to that conversation?
Well, my contribution is exactly what I was saying, that, you know, Batsonga would say, Banvotala Banasubati. So you've got to look at him in totality, but also be able to point out, Kureno, Unasubati Sotala. In that sense. So, yes, I mean, one has to accept that, you know, regardless of what the reasons were, him unbanning the liberation movement, allowing political parties and political prisoners to come back home, starting the negotiations was important. It's very easy to say, well, you know, it was not out of will. I agree. But if there's someone who met with Mandela a few times, it would be P.W. Botha. But remember, even after the Rand crashed in 1985, he did not flinch. In fact, the closest he came was to try and say to Mandela, denounce the ANC, denounce the armed struggle, then we'll release you. But it was more like we'll release you to the trans guy, you know. So so you've got that part, and then you've got the rest of the part that I said, that he was a conservative in general, and of course oversaw the death of many people, and that when he went to the TRC, he did not tell the truth and the whole truth.
As you say that about the truth, people are skeptical now with the apology video that we've just seen. The questions as to what exactly is his aim with that video?
I think it's more like, you know, being calculative that, well, when I'm dead, how do I ensure that people remember me? I know that once I'm dead, they are going to say I was an apartheid denialist. So maybe let me acknowledge the hurt and everything, you know. But it's too little too late. It would have been better if he had done it when he was still alive, when he was in shape, when people could ask him, look, let's accept that you may not have been involved in the killing. But tell us what exactly did that memo that was sent when you were Minister of Education that spoke about the elimination of the credit score? What do you know about the TrustFeed massacre? Do you really think you don't know what happened with regard to these issues of we patron and so forth? Obviously, you know, those kind of things. And I think if he was to say, look, this is what I know, and maybe it would help bring closure and or prosecution, I think people would be able to say, well, it was late, but I think some people would be willing to forgive.
And you were there at CODESA, so you were part of those negotiations. You was in Parliament, you were there, and I've seen him at close range. I wonder if you have any anecdote that you want to perhaps share of a close experience or encounter you've had with him.
No, I mean, I leave those to my friend Peter Mbowin, because it seems he had a closer relationship.
Yeah.
No. I think, I mean, I know the relationship from a point of view of as in negotiation.
Yeah.
But remember, even in the negotiation, just like Mandela, he was not in all the meetings. He was just a principal. Also, like I was saying, I mean, it's many people who were there at CODESA 1. You find that the ANC agreed to speak first. Many people spoke and so forth. And it was all kosher. Until then, you know, he said something about NK calling for their disbandment and things which had been discussed between him and Mandela and the ANC to say, look, don't bring up this kind of things because you're just going to make everybody angry. And I think many people will remember when Madiba said, I have a point of national importance to make. And he just turned to the guy and said, even, you know, an illegitimate leader, someone like you, is supposed to have some integrity, but you really just don't have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Slow. I appreciate your time.
That was a Capricorn FM podcast. For more podcasts, visit capricornfm.co.za.